Okay, thank you very much, Lars. So, Lars gave me some very specific instructions on how to prepare this talk, and I hope it's going to work. I'm planning to spend some time sort of describing very basic knowledge level that we have about the interior of the Earth, and then spend some time telling you about some more specific hot research topics, in particular in seismology, which is my field, for the rest of the talk. So for those of you who know everything about the Earth, you will have to excuse me for this simple. But okay, so let's start. So at the very first order approximation, the Earth is spherical. It's made of spherical shells, and this knowledge comes primarily from seismology, in fact, from investigating the Earth structure using seismic waves, even though already in the 19th century, when it was possible to measure the accurately the mass of the Earth, it became clear that the comparison of the density of the Earth's surface of the Earth with the mass indicated that the Earth needed to have a core, a denser core. Currently, we have a pretty good idea of the average structure of the Earth, or as we call it, the reference, spherically symmetric structure of the Earth. Essentially, on the top, you see the different layers. There is a mantle, which is made of silicates, and then there is a core made of iron. The mantle is solid, the outer core is liquid, and then there is a small inner core, which is solid. The core is mostly iron with about 10% light inclusions, and the inner core is more pure iron than the outer core. I'm going to be focusing mostly on the mantle in this talk, and so just note that the mantle is divided into the upper mantle and the lower mantle. The distinction between the upper and the lower mantle is along this seismically detected so-called discontinuity at 670 kilometers, which corresponds to a significant jump in both elastic velocities and density. So this is going to be sort of a focus, this discontinuity here. What is its role in the mantle dynamics? The other, of course, boundary of importance is the core mantle boundary, the limit between the silicate solid mantle and the liquid iron core, which is both a thermal boundary and a chemical boundary. There is another discontinuity in the upper mantle around 400 kilometers, which is believed to be a phase transition in olivine. The 670 kilometers is also thought to be a phase transition, but it may involve also a compositional component. So this is the static view as we have it today. And of course, the crust of the Earth on top is not even visible on this picture. It's about, on average, 30 kilometers thick. But what we're really interested in is the departures from this static model to basically learn about what goes on from a dynamic point of view. We want to know, in particular, what drives the plate tectonics, what drives the motions of the plates at the surface of the Earth. This is, of course, related to some type of solid convection inside the mantle. We know we have some boundary conditions at the surface of the Earth. The plates move away from each other at mid-ocean ridges. They converge at trenches, at subduction zones. We have some good evidence of the oceanic plates plunging under mostly continental plates at these trenches. But beyond that, the scale of the mantle convection is actually still in debate. And one of the ways to try and get a handle on this is, of course, by seismological methods, which is what I will concentrate on. So this is another view, a little bit more of complex of what goes on in the mantle. I singled out this picture because it has this transition zone, which is between these two upper mantle discontinuities, that is a source of a focus of studies right now, and exactly what role it plays in the dynamics. There is the downgoing flow, which we can trace near the surface, but we have questions about what happens to it deeper. And then, of course, the upgoing flow, how or, you know, does it have an active role? Is it passive return flow? And I just wanted to point out another phenomenon, which is related to upwelling. We know that matter is coming out of mid-ocean ridges, hot material. But there's also the phenomenon of hot spots, which are basically island, volcanic island chains that seem to be riding, where the plate seems to be overriding some fixed source of heat, of hot material, creating island chains, volcanic island chains, such as you have, for example, in Hawaii, where the age of the volcano is older and older as you sort of move away from the currently active volcanoes. So the origin of hotspots, whether they're grounded shallow or whether they're of deep origin, whether they go all the way, come all the way down from the core mantle boundary, and what is their role in the global circulation compared to the circulation that we observe at the ridges, is another topic of interest right now. So what we know about the Earth and its dynamics comes basically from a combination of different fields in geophysics, seismology, which I will focus on, but also geodynamics modeling, convection modeling, in simulating convection in numerical models that have in analog conditions to the Earth. Mineral physics, which tells us about the composition and the variations with pressure and temperature of Earth material. And finally, geochemistry, which analyzes the rocks at the surface of the Earth and tries to relate that to what might be going on in the mantle deep inside. So all these different disciplines together come up with the models, which on which there's still a lot of controversial argumentation. The two kind of extreme models here, number one and two, are models in one in which the global circulation extends to the whole mantle. Essentially, you have a relatively homogeneous mantle with downgoing slabs here all the way to the core mantle boundary, upwellings all the way from the core mantle boundary, some of them perhaps interacting or originating at this 670-kilometer discontinuity. So that's one extreme view. The other extreme view, which is favored by many geochemists based on some isotope data for rare elements and noble gases, which indicates that there might be this discontinuity, which at 670 kilometers might actually be a likely location of basically a separation, a complete separation between the upper mantle and the lower mantle, and so that you'd have two separate convection systems, and that isolating primordial mantle from depleted upper mantle. In fact, more recent results, in particular, as I illustrate from seismology, tend to indicate that the reality is probably somewhere in between. And so these new generation models have been debated in recent times in order to explain the isotopic data and some data on the heat flux of the Earth. The geochemists need to have somewhere, perhaps hidden in the mantle, an enriched region, or which, so there's been, people have been looking for maybe a layer of at the bottom of the mantle, which would account for these observations. Another way of accounting for this would be to distribute this primordial element all through the lower mantle. And associated with these are, of course, questions of whether the slabs that originate in the subduction zones, in the lithospheric plates, can penetrate through the boundary here at 670 kilometers, whether they always penetrate, whether only some of them under particular conditions, such as, for example, flushing events, gigantic events that accumulate over geological times and happen more rapidly, whether the plumes upwellings that give rise to the hotspots, whether they originate at the core mantle boundary and go straight through, whether they might originate at the top of this layer, or whether they might originate at the 670-kilometer discontinuity. So we have a variety of range of models that we're trying to test, essentially. And just to summarize, some of the key questions that are being considered right now: is the global circulation a one-layer circulation, a two-layer circulation, or one and a half, meaning you can have communication between upper and lower mantle, but not everywhere or not all the time? What is the fate of the subducted slabs? Do they go all the way to the lowermost mantle? Do they encounter some boundary in the middle? What is the role of these mantle plumes in the global circulations? Where are these chemical reservoirs that we may need to have in somewhere in the deepest part of the mantle? And finally, the role of what is called the D double prime layer, which is the lowermost layer, 250 kilometers of the mantle, just before the core mantle boundary, which is seismically a very distinct region where the gradients of elastic velocities is more flattens out, and which has been documented as the region of very strong variations in lateral structure. So, so seismology is, of course, currently the most powerful investigative method, because it allows you to actually sample what's inside the Earth all the way down to the core. And so, as you know, there are elastic waves, there's two types, compressional and shear waves, and a typical seismogram, which a seismologist always has to show in a seminar, will consist of a sequence of arrivals, with the first compressional wave that goes practically straight through the mantle. It turns around because of the increase in velocity as a function of depth. So it turns around and goes back to the surface, then followed by the shear wave, and then followed by waves that are trapped near the surface of the Earth, called surface waves, also of two types, Rayleigh and Love waves. And so there's quite a richness here. To give you an idea of the sort of bandwidth, typical seismological observations can observe on a day's time scale, at which level you can see the tide, the solid tide of the Earth. And earthquakes appear as these disturbances. Very large earthquakes here, magnitude 6.8, for example, would look like this on this time scale. On the time scale of hours, you pick up the Rayleigh waves or the Love waves, the surface waves, the long period surface waves that circle around the Earth many times. You can see the energy wave packets attenuating with time. And if you combine all of these into a computer spectrum, you get the normal mode spectrum of the Earth, which is here an example for two different very large deep events that were recorded in 1994 and generated a very rich spectrum of eigenmodes. These eigenmodes are one of the basic pieces of information to determine the average structure of the Earth. The eigenfrequencies can be related to simple structures using normal mode theory. At the minute time scale, which is the one that I'll be more focusing on, you can start seeing the individual phases. And here's just a typical type of data, waveform data set that we collect, where you have three component instruments, one vertical, two horizontal, that will pick up the different types of motion, the compressional, shear, and there are different multiples as they interact with the structure inside the Earth. So again, there are different phases that we observe. They either go straight from the source to the receiver, or they will reflect at the surface of the Earth very strongly, at the core mantle boundary very strongly, but also at these intermediate discontinuities, and create a richness of waveform observations containing pure shear or pure compressional and also converted phases. So the technique, well, there's different techniques in seismology, but the one that's applied for the study of the global structures is a seismic tomography. This is, of course, very analogous to medical imagery, where now the parameters that's mostly measured is travel times of waves, as opposed to medicine, it's mostly attenuation of various types of waves. So here I just want to, the point is, in order to find out about the dynamics, we want to isolate the regions of upwelling, which are supposedly hot, and the regions of downwelling that are cold. Elastic velocities as used as proxy, mainly for temperature. This is complicated by the fact that there's also some compositional heterogeneity, which needs to be taken into account, and which then complicates the interpretation of the images. But to a large extent, to first order, the interpretation of the tomographic images is first in terms of temperature. So the color coding is fast will be blue, and we think about it as cold, and slow will be red. And of course, the tomographic technique, basically you compare observations of travel times or amplitudes with a reference model, homogeneous in the case of, shown here, in the case of the Earth, it would be the reference depth dependence, spherically symmetric model. And by having many paths from many sources to many stations, you can set up an inverse problem to find both the location of the heterogeneity and its amplitudes. Now, contrary to the medical situation where you can basically put receivers and sources all around the body, we are limited in seismology by the fact that our sources are natural earthquakes, which do not occur are not distributed uniformly around the Earth. They mostly occur on plate boundaries. So in fact, this figure here shows you is almost a sort of a picture of the lithospheric plate boundaries around the Earth. You can see the most active regions are the subduction zones. Here, the ring of fire around the Pacific, the Western Pacific, Aleutians, and then South America. And then you can sort of image the mid-ocean ridges here all around the Pacific, the Indian Ocean, the Atlantic. And very rarely do you get so-called intraplate events inside the plates. So we are limited in the distribution of sources, and likewise we're limited in the distribution of stations, which for the most part have to be on land, right? At least right now. It is relatively straightforward to install a seismic station on land, possibly on an island. This is not a complete picture. There are more stations. There are now stations on every possible, almost possible islands. The island stations are particularly noisy because of the interference with atmosphere rig disturbances. But anyway, we also have a problem in terms of distribution of stations. And a solution to this, of course, is to extend the network into the oceans, but this is still quite challenging and expensive proposition. So next is, okay, so what kind of data sets do we collect? We collect for tomographic purposes. There's basically two types of data sets. One is a data set of parametric data, essentially travel times, arrival times of different phases, and mostly the first arrivals, the P arrivals, because they are the cleanest. They come out of the noise and are not disturbed by signal generated noise as the earthquake is already happening. So, and over the last 30 years, this organization, the International Seismological Center, which is in England, has been collecting bulletins from individual stations all over the world, just collecting the parametric data. So the advantage is there's just hundreds and hundreds of thousands of data points available, but there is no quality control. So in order to be able to use these data, you need to apply statistical averaging techniques to ensure the robustness of the results. On the other hand, in the last 15 to 20 years, there has been a major effort on the international scale to deploy so-called broadband, three-component digital stations, which are now collected at a number of data centers where the whole waveforms are available. So not only the arrival times, but also the richness in frequency and as a function of time. Individual researchers can actually analyze those data themselves and therefore control, not only have a broader range of much more richer information, but also much better control on the quality. So likewise, the tomographic models that have been developed in the last 15 years have been of two types. The so-called, what we call high-resolution models are based on these International Seismological Center bulletin data, mostly on the first arrival P wave, compressional wave, and they generally are parametrized in local functions, so most generally blocks that may be a couple hundred kilometers dimension. And the theory, which allows you to compute the forward model to compare with the data, is the ray theory, which is an infinite frequency approximation, which works reasonably well for P waves, which have the main frequency content is around 1 second. And then you contrast this with another generation of models, which we call the long wavelength models, which are now based more on the information coming from these broadband stations. These are, in contrast, mostly models of shear velocity, and they use the information contained in surface waves. In the normal mode, we call them splitting coefficients. The heterogeneity in the Earth splits the normal mode peaks, and so you get information about heterogeneity from measuring the splitting, and travel times or waveforms of a variety of phases, which now are hand-picked and well-controlled. These models, usually until recently, exclusively, but things are progressively changing, use a global parametrization in general, based on spherical harmonics. The reason for doing that is that the theoretical underlying for the forward model is usually summation of normal modes, and so because the Earth is spherical, the natural base is that of spherical harmonics. So I'll show you some of the pictures that have come out recently from these type of modelings. This is an example of some cross-section through the Earth from one of these high-resolution so-called models. You'll see why they're called high resolutions. These models primarily give us information around subduction zones, around these zones in the Western Pacific, to some extent here in America, and the convergence zone around the Mediterranean. The reason being that's where you have most of the seismicity and also the most denser network of stations. So you can get reasonably short wavelength information from these data. And they're based on the IAC bulletins. And the interesting result, which is here sort of illustrated, is that they have enabled us to image the fast downgoing slabs in these regions and have shown that, in fact, you have a variety of behavior. Those little lines here, this is the 660 kilometer discontinuity, this is this discontinuity which is thought to be a possible barrier to flow, a strong barrier to flow, and you can see that depending whether you are here in Central America, this section here, there is an indication that the slab originating here goes down and penetrates through the 670 kilometer discontinuity to rather great depths in the mantle. On the other hand, a cross-section through Japan, like up there, indicates that this particular slab seems to be sitting on the 670 kilometer discontinuity. The actual fate of the slabs, whether they go all the way down, is not really well resolved yet in these models. There is some indication that perhaps this slab, for example, has something to do with this fast anomaly. The CMB, by the way, is the core mantle boundary in our field. So the advantage of these approaches is that you get relatively short wavelength, crisp pictures around the subduction zone that I just illustrated. On the other hand, in the oceans, there is very little information from this type of data set. And this illustrates this is the density of rays that is available from the IAC bulletins, the sampling at different depths in the mantle, here just below the 670 kilometer discontinuity and here at the core mantle boundary. And you can see that in the mid-mantle, there is practically very few data for the oceans. And by the time you get to the core mantle boundary, this data set isn't really adequate anymore at all. So the long wavelength models, on the other hand, because they use the surface waves that can traverse the oceans and give you constraints on structure in the upper mantle across the oceans, even when there are no stations there, and because they use multiply reflected waves at different at the surface of the Earth and at the core mantle boundary in particular, they allow you to get a better sampling on the average of the Earth. However, they also give you the resolution, the lateral resolution is not as good because of the distribution of the data is still not uniform everywhere. So this is a comparison of four competing models, recent competing models, one from our group in Berkeley, Harvard, this is Scripps, and this is Caltech, which gives you sort of an idea of the range of results that are currently observed. These are shear velocities, three different depths, and in the uppermost mantle, in the mid-mantle, and right near the core mantle boundary. There are some long wavelength characteristics of these models are in very good agreement, so things that we know really are there, and these models have been developed using slightly different data sets, different theoretical approaches, etc. So in the topmost mantle, the structure that you get in shear velocity is reminiscent, very strongly reminiscent of the tectonics. You can see the hot regions associated with the ridges, the ridge system, here the East Pacific Rise, Indian Ridge, and the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. The cold region, the fast regions, as proxy for cold, are the shields, the geological old parts of the lithosphere, here in Canadian Shield, the Brazilian, in Eurasia, Australia, etc. You can also see in some of the pictures it's more evident than in others, perhaps the two top ones, you can see a variation in the ocean as a function of the distance from the ridge, the velocity becomes higher, and this is indicative of the cooling of the lithospheric plate, so that's pretty visible. The differences that you see at this level between the models, in fact, can be related not to one group doing things better than others, but to another phenomenon which can be measured in this type of studies, which is anisotropy, the fact that the seismic waves travel faster in some directions than others, which can be related to the intrinsic anisotropic structure of olivine, which is the main constituent of the upper mantle, and can also tell us something about the dynamics, about the flow directions, although these relations are not necessarily very direct. Okay, so now we go down into the mantle. About 200, 300 kilometers down the mantle, you start losing this relation with the tectonics. In the lowest upper mantle, which I'm not showing, you do see the subduction zones, the slabs in the Western Pacific and in Central America. By the time you get to 1,000 kilometers, you see the spectrum has changed. While the spectrum of the heterogeneity near the surface is relatively biased to long wavelengths, basically degrees up to degree 6 to 8, in the mid-mantle, it's much more white. Small-scale heterogeneity, not very well resolved, still quite a lot of consistency between different models. And then by the time you get to the very close to the core mantle boundary in this D double prime region, the last 300 kilometers, perhaps even the last 500 kilometers, the structure again becomes much more red, much more dominated by long wavelengths. And there are two dominant structures that I want to point out are these low velocity structures in the middle of the Pacific and under Africa, which are referred to, which are thought to be the roots of giant upwellings that are referred to as superplumes. And then there's a ring of high velocities around these zones, which are thought to be related, but that still remains to be proven, to accumulation of slab material falling through the mantle. Incidentally, the heterogeneity is on the order of a few percent with respect to an average depth-dependent structure. Here I'm showing the root mean square amplitude of lateral heterogeneity as a function of depth for these different models, four of these different models, which shows again that there is strong lateral variations related to the upper mantle thermal boundary layer, thermal and chemical boundary layer. And then the heterogeneity has a much lower level in mid-mantle. But then again, you can see that the lower boundary layer here with the core, getting to near the core, is again increase in the strength of heterogeneity. So these are constraints that are important for any geodynamical numerical modeling, in particular of the Earth mantle. This is just to show that these two types of tomographic models are actually consistent with each other. These are now maps around Japan. You can see the Japanese islands here, and this is Asia, at different depths across the 670 kilometer discontinuity. One is one of these P high resolution model up here. It's a model by a Japanese group. And this is one of our models at Berkeley, which is one of these long wavelength models based on S on shear velocities. And you can see that to a large extent, the long wavelength models are basically a long wavelength filtering of those models, high resolution models, but they provide a better sort of coverage on the global scale. What is not accessible from the high-resolution models right now is the structure in these upwelling regions, and in particular these superplumes. So this is a cross-section across Africa showing the kind of structure we observe. Now five different models of shear velocity. We've added a model here from University of Texas, which shows this gigantic structure, starting, originating with this rather wide bays at the core-mantle boundary and extending rather high into the mantle. And the question then is, what is the role of these structures in the global circulation? Is this just a thermal structure? Does it have a chemical component? And does it reach all the way through the 670 kilometer discontinuity and play some important role in the upper mantle dynamics or not? So just to summarize, so the long wavelength shear models are not as sharp, don't give us as sharp images right now, at least in subduction zones, but they provide better resolution under oceans in general, in the upper mantle and at the very base of the mantle, better coverage. It provides the means to have resolution of the lowermost degree heterogeneity and their access to the spectrum of heterogeneity. It gives us, because you can work with three-component data, it gives us access to the study of anisotropy and its relation to flow in the upper mantle in particular. But perhaps the most important right now is that it provides insights into the slow regions that that are associated with the upwelling flow. And to date, there are still limitations. We can go much further in these modeling attempts. And the limitations is that most of these models still don't use all of the information contained in the waveform seismograms. Most of them use only travel times of well-separated arrivals of specific phases. They rarely take into account diffracted waves on the core-mantle boundary, which is the main source of information about the structure at this level in the mantle. And most of these models don't use the quite right theoretical approach for modeling broadband body waves. So these are this is a state of the art, essentially, and where the progress is being made right now, needs to be made. So this is an illustration of the main phases that are used in most of these tomographic models. The direct S phase, the SS, maybe a triple, the phase that reflects twice, same on the core-mantle boundary. These phases are well separated on the seismogram. But if you look, this is sort of a standard travel time curve for identifying the different phases that can be seen on seismograms as a function of distance from the epicenter and time here in minutes. You can see the richness of phases, especially in this distance range, which pertains to the mantle. Once you get in this range, this has to do with phases that sample the core. A lot of these are not well separated on the seismogram, so you can't really measure the travel time. So the only way to approach that is to use a waveform formalism, and that's part of the effort that we're now involved in at Berkeley, is to go beyond the travel time approach and use full waveforms. Now, the problem with using full waveforms is that you have to the way to do this is to compare the observed waveforms with synthetics. And so the synthetics have to be computed accurately. And the standard approach is to compute them using summation of normal modes, and then to use perturbation theory to account for the coupling of the modes due to lateral heterogeneity. And in a standard approach, this coupling is treated in a very simple asymptotic way, because heterogeneity is supposed to be small. And the standard way of doing this is by just including so-called a long branch coupling in the synthetic normal mode seismograms, which is a valid approximation for surface waves, but it breaks down for body waves. So if you want to do diffracted waves, or if you want to do body waves in general, waves that travel through all the sample deep into the mantle, you need to include a cross mode branch coupling. And what we've been using at Berkeley is an asymptotic approach to that, which is not perfect, but it's the next step, which allows you to have 2D broadband sensitivity kernels for the seismograph. And finally, the third element here is to account for effects of focusing and defocusing of waves due to lateral heterogeneity, and so include the off-path, so-called off-path propagation effect. So this is just an example. You compare, this is the, you separate the SH and SV polarization components and compare a synthetic seismogram to an observed one and isolate wave packets of energy and basically set a big inverse problem to improve the fit of the synthetics to the observations. And here's just an illustration of what the issue is that the standard sort of approach to tomography uses either ray theory, which shows the rays here, infinite frequency dependence of a structure only on the infinitesimal ray, or this path average approximation for surface waves, where the dependence on structure is only on the average structure along the slice between the source and the receiver. Obviously, that doesn't work well for body waves and also for broadband body waves. This approach that we've been using, which in particular was developed here by Toshiro Tanimoto at UC Santa Barbara, made some contributions to this. You can now have a sensitivity which is takes into account both the ray characteristics and the broadband characteristics. Sensitivity extends away from the ray and varies as a function of position along the ray. In particular, you see full amplification of the sensitivity at points of reflection, source and receiver, etc. So if you want to get to a higher resolution, this is what you need to do. You need to have more accurate kernels. And this is just an example of what happens if you don't, is if you use a too simple approximation. This is a so-called checkerboard test, where we put in a synthetic model made of a checkerboard like this at some depth in the mantle. We invert it using one or the other of the theories. And what is it that we get out depending on the theory and depending on where we put the initial model? So if in the upper mantle, you get back the initial model quite well because the surface wave, the upper mantle is mostly surface wave sensitivity. But once you get to the lower mantle, you get poor resolution just based on the poor theoretical approximation. So you need to go to a better theory, in addition to improving, of course, the sampling as much as possible. This is another example. Now a vertical cross section or the upper mantle, input model, output using a somewhat improved cross branch coupling method. This is the standard surface wave inversion. You get the right kind of shape if you're just interested in the lowest degrees, but if you want to see the details, you both lose the shape and you lose the amplitude. So back to this picture of the South African anomaly, a lot of the focus again is to see whether these structures, how far they extend into the mantle, how active they are in the dynamics, and perhaps some of the differences between these models, which then may be related to the theoretical treatment, may actually be important. Our model up here, which is based on this coupling theory, seems to indicate that this plume actually is pretty strong, although at least all the way to the upper mantle. But right now there is no reference model, no absolute reference model that we can compare it to really say whether this is right or not. So in conclusion about elastic tomography, the high-resolution P-models have allowed us to gain information about subducting slabs, that some of them penetrate into the lower mantle, some of them don't seem to rest on the 670 kilometers continuity. The long wavelength models see the same features, but filtered to long wavelengths. They provide information on slow regions, and we have these two major plumes that are extending from the core mantle boundary high into the lower mantle, and perhaps all the way to the upper mantle, and the key is waveform tomography. There's another aspect to waveform tomography which is promising, which is that if you have a waveform approach, you also have access to amplitude information, not only phase. And amplitude information gives you access to attenuation, intrinsic attenuation, which is another, an independent way of sampling the mantle. Attenuation is very strongly dependent on temperature, so it provides additional constraints that may in particular separate the effects of compositional variations from temperature variations. And it allows you also to address such issues as dispersion due to attenuation. This is just a cartoon showing the very schematically the velocity, the temperature depends on the velocity compared to that of attenuation, and indicates that attenuation will have will allow you to kind of zoom in and resolve better the regions that have higher temperature. So we've been setting up inversion for attenuation, or its inverse Q, and basically do this in an iterative fashion. First, elastic structure, where you align the waveform phase with the synthetics, and then in the second step, you extract the information in the amplitude to find the Q or the attenuation model. So far, this has been possible only for the upper mantle, and it's actually a sort of an order of magnitude harder problem than the elastic structure, because the amplitudes are very strongly affected by the propagation of elastic waves through a 3D medium that creates focusing and defocusing. And so until we have a very, and they're dependent on these very strongly on the gradients of structure, so the details of the model. So until we have very accurate elastic models, it is very, very difficult to estimate and extract the elastic part in the amplitudes from the anelastic part. So that's why these models are still pretty smooth and long wavelengths. This shows a recent model that we've constructed now of attenuation in the upper mantle, where very briefly you see at the top of the mantle, again, the correlation. High attenuation now is red, and low attenuation is high, is blue. Again, this is would be cold, this would be hot. And you can follow the ridge system in at the top of the mantle down to about 250 kilometers. You can see the cold shields. And as you go deeper into what we call this transition zone, just above the 670 kilometers continuity, the structure changes, and something which is not as apparent in the velocity models are these features with two high attenuation peaks in the middle of the Pacific and under Africa, which are sort of the main striking features of these models so far, still pretty coarse. But the interesting thing about them is that they seem to correlate quite well with the location of these hotspots. Here, the black dots are the main hotspots around the Earth, and these high attenuation regions appear to be related to those quite well. This is another view from Africa, where you can also see from this, from the other side of the Earth, this correlation in the transition zone. So, more interestingly, now looking only at the very long wavelengths, which we believe are already pretty well resolved, the attenuation structure in the transition, upper mantle transition zone here at 500 kilometers depth correlates almost perfectly with the velocity structure that we see near the core mantle boundary. It correlates so well that it's hard to believe that this is fortuitous, and has leads us to believe that there is, in fact, this connection between these upwellings originating, or these hot regions, or slow velocity regions, originating at the core mantle boundary, and these structures in the transition zone of the upper mantle. So there must be either transfer of matter through the 670 kilometer discontinuity, or at least some thermal coupling, inducing upwellings from the lower mantle to the upper mantle. These are cross sections showing examples through this African plume. The lower panel shows the velocity structure, and the upper panel we connect with the upper panel showing the attenuation structure. And you can see this large upwelling, which seems to narrow down, and it's actually complicated depending on where you take the cross sections, it may have several branches to it. And in the upper mantle, you see a continuation. And then under the blue or fast lithosphere, a cold lithosphere, the anomaly spreads out and connects to the mid-ocean ridges, which are here indicated by these arrows. You can see this very clearly in this cross-section. So that's the same thing now for the Pacific plume. One thing to note here is the connection to Hawaii. Hawaii being the most prominent hotspot, there is a lot of attention given to this hotspot and to its origin. There are many sort of theories as to where it's originated, at which depth it originates. Here it seems like this anomaly spreads out towards the north, towards Hawaii, at relatively shallow depths, maybe 200 to 300 kilometers depths. Another feature is, again, this is for the Pacific, so it's the same picture in attenuation here. Here we show the one measure of anisotropy, which is comparing the velocities in the transverse direction and in the vertical direction, velocity SH minus velocity SV, which here indicates that there's associated with this shift or in the position of the anomaly, or which you might interpret as a dynamic upwelling that's moving horizontally towards the ridges. This is supported by this anisotropic high SH velocity, indicating that there's a strong component of shear or of, horizontal component of the flow. The combination of, this is just to illustrate the different tools that we have in seismic tomography and that are being currently developed, a combination of the standard velocity tomography for the whole mantle, the Q tomography, which we are now able to start addressing in the upper mantle, and a study of anisotropy, both this transverse anisotropy and another component, which is looking at the azimuthal or direction of the fast axis of anisotropy in the horizontal direction, can bring important constraints on the dynamics of the upwelling part of the global circulations. And so far, what we know is that there are these superplumes that are rising from the core mantle boundary high into the upper mantle or interacting with the upper mantle, and the flow in the upper mantle seems to be merging into the layer beneath the lithosphere, which is the a softer layer called the asthenosphere, and deflect towards the mantle. And may one of the proposed roles of the superplumes is that they actually may help lubricate the plate motions by basically providing heat into the asthenosphere. So challenges for the future: we need to develop more sophisticated waveform tomographic approach, going to shorter and shorter periods to get more and more of the details of the structure, use more richer information contained in the seismograms. We also need to improve the coverage, and that's not a trivial undertaking, in particular access the ocean bottom, and then also complement the inverse methods with accurate forward modeling, which can be done in regions where you have dense sampling, good source and good receiver sampling. So I just wanted to illustrate where we're going with this. This is just a conceptual figure showing that right now, until now, we've been using approximate perturbation theory based on normal mode summation to compute synthetic seismograms. Very soon, we'll be able to do the same using numerical methods. It has the advantage of doing the computation exactly. The disadvantage is that you have a little less physical insight on what's going on. But recently, this method, spectral element method, based on, it's essentially a finite element method, has been developed for the spherical Earth, which seems to work very well in terms of what you can parameterize and the wave field you can generate for global applications. It's still a slow and requires large clusters of computers to generate even just a field for one earthquake. But in the very near future, this will probably supersede the more analytical methods that we're using. And also, in the meantime, we can already make such computations to try and understand better individual features that we see in seismograms, and test also the validity of the approximations that have been used so far. The ocean bottom, the community is getting organized to establish long-term observatories on the ocean floor. The issue here is, first of all, how do you bring the energy? How do you take the data out? And also there are some very serious issues about installation. The ocean floor is noisy. You want to get away from the noise. The best way to do this is to drill holes on the ocean floor, so that's very expensive and have to team up with the ocean drilling program to do so, and also team up with other parts of the community, the oceanographic community, physical oceanography, and also other parts of the solid earth community, such as the geodesists and the geomagnetists, to jointly establish these facilities. But there is an organization called ION, the International Ocean Network, which was started by seismologists and has established targeted regions on the ocean floor where there had not been any stations, any seismic stations, in regions of about 2,000 by 2,000 kilometers, and which would be the ideal targets for that these ocean floor efforts. And in fact, since this organization was developed, in fact, this map actually existed already about 5 years before that, but a number of these observatories have already been installed, and so you can see there's been experiments. There is now a permanent station here midway between Hawaii and California called H2O, Hawaii to Ocean. And there have been temporary observatories. The Japanese have been very active and have two permanent installations now for the last year. There has been a hole which has been drilled recently here, Ocean Seismic Network 2 hole. There is a hole in the Indian Ocean that needs to be instrumented, etc. So their efforts are going on, but if you compare with a land-based network, we're still, this is sort of very incremental and happening very slowly. And of course, with all the difficulties involved, like this robot-assisted installation offshore California that we've been involved in. So with that, I'd like to stop here. Question. Right, you could do that. How far off? Well, the Russians have a vibrator that they would like us to install in California, in fact, to try this. I mean, yes, theoretically you could do that. From a practical point of view, it's pretty. You still need to. It's a big annoyance, though. In terms of the noise you'd be generating before you can actually get the signal to build up to the levels you would want it.
So what are the advantages of that over a spectrum that you don't control?
Well, yeah, of course there would be an advantage. That's another sort of aspects of all of this that I didn't even touch upon, is the source spectrum and the source functions, say the directivity functions, etc., which we actually do invert for simultaneously. And if if we knew that perfectly, of course, that would be, you know, one of the problems would be removed. But the reality of doing this, well, we, you know, maybe we're going to do this with these Russians, I don't know, but I can only see the difficulty of the practical, the logistics of this. We'd want to do it everywhere, right? Like, many places. Well, they certainly, I mean, the experiments that are done, in particular in the experimental tanks of, you know, analog experiments, indicate that you have different regimes depending on exactly the boundary conditions and the nature of the medium or the fluid. So you expect them to be, to a certain extent, transient. The question is, what is the time scale? And in fact, these plumes, if you relate them, you can relate them to, I didn't mention that, to two large features in the middle of the Pacific and under Africa, which are called super swells. They're slightly higher than they should be in the from the point of view of topography, so they have to be dynamically sustained. And if you look at the geological history of the superswells, there is a sort of a 150 million year kind of, seems to be a, you know, cycle on those. So on those scales, yes. But it's very hard in the laboratory to even get anything that's stable on these time periods. You have to have, well, the way that it's being achieved right now is by having a two-layer fluid with a denser fluid at the bottom that with different temperature-dependent viscosity that acts like a lava lamp, maybe, and you can get this kind of thing. So.
Yeah, you said something about the inner crystal related to the crystal structure of olivine. I didn't quite catch that. I mean, are you assuming that there's a lot of
olivine? You know, the olivine crystals are anisotropic. No, you don't have a single crystal, but they will. If there is flow, they will align in some way with the flow, okay? Problem is, you might think they'd align directly with the flow. In fact, due to different effects of pressure, etc., the alignment is not necessarily right, you know, directly along the flow, and so this creates complications in the interpretation. But to first order, yes. Well, but you know, you have to think in terms of geological times, you know, small strain rates, but integrated over 100 million years or, you know, tens of millions of years, does give you a strong signal. And the signal is strong, it's several percent anisotropy. But extracting is difficult because you, if you want to do it right, you have to have 13 13 parameters of the stress tensor and, you know, it's an inverse problem, which is much more difficult than just inverting for one or two velocities.